Her academic life in the EM blog is bigger than an untreated hernia in an 80-year-old obese man.
Ouch.
Her team is smarter than the genetic crossbreeding of Dr. Spock and Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, baby.
She drops more pearls than a new Tiffany attendant. It's Michelle Lynn and the Lynn Session.
Lynn. Hey guys, it's Michelle Lynn, and here I am going to introduce to you one of my new favorite people in the world, Dr. Kavita Babu, who is the Associate Professor of EM and Director of Medical Toxicology Fellowship at the University of Massachusetts. And Kavita is a national renowned expert on opioid use in the ED. And just a little bit of background, actually, I first got to meet... Well, technically, we've never met, but virtually meet Kavita, one of our global EM journal clubs that we're hosting between Annals of EM and my site, Academic Life. And the topic of discussion was about NED administration of analgesics and Press-Ganey satisfaction scores. Boo.
No!
And you know, nothing gets EM providers all riled up as much as that darn satisfaction instrument.
Rubbish, filth, slime, muck.
Boo! Boo!
During that time, my alarms did go off because one of my secret talents in life is to recognize superstars and finding ways to just hang out with them. So when Kavita's new paper came out early in Press and Annals, I jumped at the chance to invite her on the podcast to share her thoughts on it. And the title of this paper is Preventing Iatrogenic Overdose, a Review of In-Emergency Department Opioid-Related Adverse Drug Events and Medication Errors. This is senior authored by Kavita, and from what I gather, it's a retrospective study at two urban EDs looking at iatrogenic opioid overdoses from electronic medical records, and it's filtered by when naloxone was given in the ED. So welcome to the podcast, Kavita.
Thanks, Michelle, and thanks so much for that introduction.
Yeah, you know what? I thought this was a perfect topic because we give opioids, IV opioids, all the time in the ED, and we just don't even blink an eye. So I thought, you know, maybe we should take just a few minutes, a little time out to talk about this, right, Kavita?
I think this is a really important topic in emergency medicine because we do. We use opioids, whether it's morphine or hydromorphone, whether it's oxycodone or hydrocodone. Those are mainstays of our practice in the emergency department. But we don't have the opportunity to talk about the potential pitfalls of opioid prescribing or opioid administration in the emergency department very often.
Yeah, so I applaud your paper. So share with us, give us the scoop on what we need to know from your paper.
Well, I think that overall, we're really good at administering opioids for the control of pain, meaning that our practice in terms of opioid administration is pretty safe overall. But when we have events, when we have adverse events related to opioid administration, those events can be life-threatening, whether we're talking about cases where patients develop hypoxia, they develop apnea, or in some cases, unfortunately, people can go on to arrest. We're not necessarily looking at those collectively as never events. Those kinds of medical errors or patient safety events that should never occur in our setting. And what we're trying to do is create the framework for how you identify those events and how you go after them systematically to make sure that they never happen to any of your patients.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing is the iatrogenesis of what we do in our practice. You know, we have so many drivers, I think, in our ED that push us towards faster, stronger pain medications for pain relief. And this is kind of the flip side of it, it sounds like.
You're totally right. I mean, I feel like during my time in emergency medicine, we've made the transition from using morphine as a mainstay of our analgesic regimen in these Northeastern emergency departments where I've worked to switching over to primarily hydromorphone or Dilaudid and fentanyl. And I think that with that change, we've seen some pretty significant adverse events that bear looking closely at.
Yeah, I mean, at our shop, we have traditionally been a very morphine-centric, morphine-heavy type institution. And only recently in the past few years, I've noticed, we're giving a little bit more Dilaudid as our first-line agent. I'm wondering if you have noticed a trend at all in terms of one certain class of medications that has been triggering all of these adverse events.
By and large, the adverse events that we've seen with opioids have been related to Dilaudid, to hydromorphone. Honestly, I think there's some sort of psychologic trap where physicians and nurses feel like giving 1 to 2 milligrams of a medication, albeit a higher potency medication, somehow sounds less threatening than giving 8 to 12 milligrams of morphine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I saw someone give 0.5 milligrams of Dilaudid, and I think one of the nurses was saying, oh, that's nothing. That's like an aerosolized dose. So yeah, the number and the actual integer is actually quite possibly a, not a distractor, but something that's working against Dilaudid in terms of underappreciating its potency.
Totally. And I think when you ask interns and residents to come up with the equianalgesic dose between Dilaudid and morphine, they can be off substantially. And so a lot of us, when we were training, we learned that the equivalent dose is 8 milligrams of morphine per milligram of Dilaudid. That number has come under a lot of scrutiny, and really the range in terms of what experts talk about now ranges from 6.7 milligrams to 10 milligrams of morphine per milligram of Dilaudid. I feel like most of us have sort of cognitively settled on 8 because it just makes a lot of sense in terms of morphine dosing.
Yeah, so it sounds like if you're going to be giving someone 8 milligrams of IV morphine, then it's probably okay to give 1 milligram of Dilaudid then.
It's hard to press the residents to feel comfortable giving 12 to 16 milligrams of morphine in a go, but they'll turn around and give 1.5 to 2 milligrams of Dilaudid without giving it a second thought.
Yeah, wow. And you're talking primarily about IV Dilaudid hydromorphone, right? Is that the primary type of administration route that occurs with your adverse events, or what about like IM?
Yes, IV is the primary route in which Dilaudid is given in our emergency departments, but we have seen adverse events after intramuscular Dilaudid administration as well. And part of the problem there, particularly in patients who get serial doses of intramuscular hydromorphone, is just that you can get this dose stacking. Anytime you give an intramuscular opioid, you know that you might have some variability in absorption based on patient physiology, based on, you know, hypotension and perfusion. But the problem is that if you're giving dose after dose after dose, IM, in some of the cases that we've reviewed, what you find is that patients get sort of a poor analgesia to start with. Providers give multiple doses, and then unfortunately they overshoot, so that not only are patients experiencing analgesia, but potentially CNS depression and respiratory depression on the back end.
You know, what our listeners actually might want to hear, if you could stay within HIPAA compliance, are, you know, can you share any of these super scary stories? Because I think hearing this framed around some real cases may drive home a lot of the learning points.
Well, sure. I wish I could say I've just had a few, but we've seen a number of cases where patients are given opioids by their providers who've gone on to require naloxone reversal, both in the ED and on the floor. And I think the way that I sort of became interested in this area in the first place is back when I was an intern, like a million years ago, I was sitting up on the floors and a code was called, and it happened to be called on the floor where I was sitting in the nursing station. And the nurses are like, you gotta go, you gotta go. Oh, you're the doctor now. I show up in this room and this woman is cyanotic with pinpoint pupils. She's not breathing. I think I actually bloodied my knuckles on her sternum. I was like, lady, you better wake up because I'm the only doctor here. And while we were getting ready to intubate this woman who was in PEA, one of the nurses said, you know, she's a surgical patient and she just got some Dilaudid. So we gave her a milligram of naloxone and it was like this amazing Lazarus effect where this woman suddenly sat up and started talking to us.
I love Wesley.
Was pink and perfused, was breathing on her own. And it was one of the first times that I realized that this was a major source of potential morbidity and mortality in this case, where a patient who had been getting an opioid for pain control post-surgically had a near-death experience in the hospital because of her medication administration.
Wow. Do you think that that whole event might have scarred you for life and possibly caused you to kind of go into this field as your area of expertise?
I think it definitely made me pay attention to this area. And then, I mean, even more recently, I had a sign out before a night shift about a woman, an 89, 90-year-old lady who had a history of end-stage renal disease, who had a humerus fracture, who was getting pain control and being admitted to the hospital in order to go into rehab the following morning. Apparently, she had gotten a Percocet, which didn't really do much for her. And then the next step up in terms of her analgesia was she got a milligram of IV Dilaudid from the emergency doc. About an hour later, she got a milligram of IV Dilaudid from the hospitalist. And when I walked by an hour after, it didn't look like she was breathing. She's blue. She's cyanotic. She's got a respiratory rate of 3. She's got a pulse ox that's unobtainable. And then again, with naloxone, this lady woke up. Didn't feel very good, but was able to regain a pulse, a pressure, a normal pulse ox. And the scary thing in these cases, Michelle, is I feel like 15, 20 minutes either way, and we'd be talking about a patient who is irrecoverable.
Wow, she would have been a total M&M case. I could see it right now.
I think the scary thing is, though, I have a feeling that there are a lot of these deaths up on the floors that go unreported because you never know. Is it a post-surgical MI? Is it a post-surgical PE? Or is some percentage of these cases a post-surgical or medical case where these patients die of an opioid overdose and nobody actually knows?
Was this person actually on a continuous pulse ox during her stay, or that was when you recognized the event?
She was not on a pulse ox. And I think that's one of the hardest questions that comes up with these patients is what is adequate monitoring? And I think that in any high-risk patient, a pulse ox is the bare minimum. I think in the ideal world, we'd be coupling end-tidal CO2 monitoring with continuous pulse oximetry in order to keep the closest eye on high-risk patients receiving high-dose opioids.
And you mentioned this patient was end-stage renal. Do you actually have to adjust this, Ashley, for anyone with liver or kidney failure?
That's a great question. Considering how often we use medications like Dilaudid, I think one of the things that we're all guilty of is just not being familiar enough with the tools in our toolbox. So there is a dose adjustment for both hepatic and renal insufficiency. In either of those cases, you should be cutting the dose by half of what you would typically administer. And there's even a recommendation that you go even slower in geriatric patients. So there's not a specific dose adjustment there, but there's a recommendation that you start with even a lower dose when you're talking about the elderly.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is outside of the scope of this talk, but this just really advocates for the point for regional blocks under ultrasound guidance, exactly to avoid all of these errors. Stepping back, in your two cases that you mentioned, you said post-ops are a little bit more high risk for these adverse events. You mentioned elderly patients. Well, who are the classes of patients who are considered higher risk?
I would refer you to the JCO Sentinel event alert on in-hospital opioid overdoses. It's a quick read, but it really does bring up this idea of risk stratification of patients who are receiving opioids. So some of the high-risk populations we would think about, the elderly, would think about patients with renal or hepatic insufficiency, anything that could potentially make you hypercarbic. So patients who are hypercarbic at baseline, patients who have sleep apnea, those patients who've had some sort of thoracoabdominal insult, whether it's trauma or surgery, that again is going to decrease their ability to clear carbon dioxide. Those are all patients that are going to be at high risk. Anyone who's receiving concomitant sedating medications, and so we talk about this a lot in our methadone patients outside of the hospital being at high risk when you add a benzodiazepine. The same thing goes while you're in the hospital as well.
I was reading a little bit more about it, and it says that the opioid naive are at high risk because obviously they're just not used to it, but also the opioid tolerant or those who are just on opioids chronically are at higher risk. I don't understand that. Explain more.
Sure. So, you know, this is really one of the traps that we see. Providers think that patients who come in on methadone or OxyContin must be used to seeing opioids. So adding opioids to the mix shouldn't be a big deal. Well, what we know is that analgesic tolerance occurs before respiratory tolerance, meaning that a lot of our patients who are on OxyContin or on methadone probably have some baseline hypoventilation or hypercarbia. So when we push just a little bit, we add opioids or benzos to their regimen, again, we can overshoot, and these are patients who are at risk of adverse events.
Wow. So you're saying their respiratory drive will go sooner than potentially their pain relief?
That's right.
Oh, my. What about fentanyl? You didn't mention that one quite yet.
If you look at all of the opioids that we use in our typical practice and you look at how they're all renally cleared, fentanyl is probably one of the better choices in patients who have renal insufficiency. I think the other benefit of fentanyl is that sometimes in the emergency department, we don't necessarily have a well-tuned sense of how long pain is going to last. So for something, say, like a shoulder dislocation, where you know that the pain is going to be fairly rapidly relieved, give the example of things like abscesses or external hemorrhoids, where you're planning a procedure that's going to give this patient relief, fentanyl might be an ideal choice because the duration of drug action is so much shorter than something like Dilaudid or morphine. Yeah, there's definitely a role for fentanyl in our practice. I think it's a good drug and a safe drug in expert hands. But the hardest part is becoming an expert with all of the different opioids that we have at our disposal.
You know, I just thought of something. I wonder if fentanyl's, besides it being just shorter acting, because of the larger digits, people don't dose it as high, right? You get 25 micrograms, 50 micrograms. Maybe we should change Dilaudid dosing to micrograms, right?
That would be totally awesome. If you're like, I'm giving 1,000 of the wanted. I think people would pay attention.
Oh my God, 500. Jeez, you are just so generous with your opioids. Anyway, we might be able to start something here, but
I like it.
Okay, good, sold.
Whoa, stop a minute. Your pancake recipe calls for 125 milligallons of milk, okay?
Give me that, 125 milligallons of milk. That's ridiculous. There's a lot of, that's way too much milk.
I know, that's why I brought it up.
Hey, we better back off on that. I don't want to turn into a cow.
That's not how it works. You don't drink a lot of milk and turn into a cow.
So let's leave the listeners now with, how about, give us 3 take-home points now from this paper and your thoughts about opioid adverse events.
If I were going to give you 3 take-home points, I would say those 3 take-home should be
1.
Choose your patients carefully when you're given opioids.
2.
Choose the drug and the dose carefully. And then finally,
3.
Make sure that you audit cases of iatrogenic opioid overdose because there's so much to take home. So when we talk about choosing the patient, I would just have an eye to these high risk factors, because when you know that there's an individual who's high risk, your tendency to monitor them more safely is going to be there. I think that when you choose the drug and the dose, you just want to be sure that, especially when you're working with trainees, when you're working with physician extenders, they understand things like the starting dose of Dilaudid is recommended is like 0.2 to 1 milligram IV, Q2 to 3 hours. And 2 milligrams IV as a bolus dose has to be very well considered before you ever administer that. And finally, I would say in reviewing these cases, when you use naloxone as a trigger to audit cases, you'll find systematic errors and practice errors. You might even find the same prescriber has a higher number of adverse events. Those are all things that can be addressed with education and with policy to make our practice safer.
Yeah. Thank you. And to piggyback onto that, you know, this EMRAP podcast actually has a comment section. And so I think if we could all somehow collectively share our stories, you know, how great would it be to learn from other people's mistakes, right? I mean, that's the best way to learn, is not to make these mistakes yourselves. But maybe together we can collectively move forward and do the right thing and reduce patient harm.
I would love to participate in the comments. Please send in your thoughts and your cases, and Michelle and I will get back to you.
Perfect. Yeah, I actually get an automatic email every time someone comments. So send them our way. Well, that's a wrap. Thanks, Kavita, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Michelle.
Yeah, that's a wrap of the Lynn sessions and the Babu sessions, Ashley. Learn it now. Use it tomorrow.